Welcome to Writers on the Beat, where crime writers meet crime fighters. I'm your host, Gavin Reese. Every episode of this podcast will bring in a variety of experts to help all writers incorporate more authentic cops, crimes, and criminals in their stories. For this episode, bestseller William Miller steps into the interrogation room just to clear up a few things about his wildly popular Jake Noble series. A Florida native, he's so far managed to escape all the untimely and creative manners of death that so often visit his neighbors, and we'll pray that lasts another 30 minutes for the interview. Following 9/11, William left a photography career to join the U.S. Army. Since leaving military service, he's traveled the world and worked jobs from forklift operation to teaching English in China. William studied creative writing at Eckerd College and wrote 4 hard-boiled mysteries for Delight Games before he released his first Jake Noble novel. A member of the International Thriller Writers, he's set to serve on a discussion panel at its annual conference in July in New York. Without further ado, William, welcome to Writers on the Beat.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be talking to you. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Well, I'm very grateful for your flattery. That'll definitely get you some kinder questions, sir. Before I do start pepping you too much with things that I want to know and lean on from your expertise and all the success that you've had as a writer and especially as an indie, first, man, I really like the Jake Noble series. I really like what you've done with that. It's incredibly well-crafted books in a series that, to me, show a ton of deliberate thought and intent and, you know, for my money, rival a lot of the thriller legends like Vince Flynn and Robert Ludlum.
Thank you so much. That is just super high praise coming from you. Thank you very much.
Well, no, I really appreciate a well-crafted book, and I'm about knee deep in one right now, and I'm very grateful for that. It's as a reader, it's it really makes all the difference, right?
It does, and you know, first and foremost, I'm a reader. I grew up reading, and so yeah, that means the world to me.
For readers who are unfamiliar with you or your work, what do you want them to know about Jake Noble and this series and the adventures you've sent him on?
You know, Jake is a real guy. You know, first and foremost, I want people to know that Jake is a real guy and not one particular individual, but a collection of people that I have known from the military, from the intelligence community, and I've sort of formed them together. And I think that's why a lot of readers feel so strongly about Jake, mm-hmm. That, you know, he's real to them. I actually had, when the last hurricane that came through here, I had readers emailing me to ask how Jake was, because, you know, he's out there on his boat. I'm like, is he okay? You know, and I did a blog post, you know, just an update. Jake's fine. His mom's fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, Jake is a real guy, and I think that's why readers connect with him so strongly. I didn't set out to write that Superman character, that James Bond who, mm-hmm. you know, James Bond's always going to make it through in the end, you know, and like his tuxedo isn't even wrinkled. Jake is a real guy, and he suffers some setbacks, and he doesn't always make the right decisions. You know, he makes mistakes.
Now, what inspired you to create Jake Noble, and how much of William Miller is actually in him?
Wow. So, the reason why I first started writing this series was my experiences in China. And, I do an email to my email list, kind of telling them where Jake Noble came from. And this is a story that I really was hesitant to tell for the longest time because it was deeply personal. But when I was in China and I was teaching English over there, at one point, it was my first semester, about halfway through the semester, one of my students disappeared, and I just couldn't figure out what had happened to her. And I was teaching college, you know, so she was a young lady, a bright young lady, really smart, good English, and she disappeared halfway through the semester, and I could not figure out what had happened to her. And there was a stone wall of silence. Like, the students weren't talking. I went to the administration. They weren't talking. I mean, they just acted like, who are you talking about? I never even heard of that person, right? So I knew something weird was going on. But, eventually I let it go. And it sort of slipped from my mind. And then a couple of weeks later, I found a student, and she was working as a prostitute there in China. Human trafficking is a big deal. It happens. It's such a huge problem in other parts of the world, and as Americans, we're so sheltered from it. And so this touched me personally. And when I got back from China, I just really wanted to shed some light on that issue. And that's where the Book of Nobleman came from. And I go a little bit further into detail in that story. Like I said, in one of my emails to my reader groups, I won't bore you with all the details right now, but, it was a really sad situation where this girl's just, she's doing what she had to do to make a living there to survive in China. And she was being punished, yes, for it. And so I stepped in and tried to help out a little bit, and I hope I did. We kept in contact for a little while, and she's, last I heard, she's doing pretty good.
Well, that's a fantastic turn of events, because, my own training experience around sex trafficking and human trafficking, at least here in the U.S., right, is almost never that kind of shining story,
it does not turn out well most of the time.
No, and it's, there are so many different factors that play into women, especially girls, getting roped into what's anecdotally called the life here, and it's always tragic, and it's always violent, and the world that they live in their reality is so horrific that people at first don't believe it's real, and they don't believe it's happening on the streets of America, and that a lot of the missing kids in the U.S. are somewhere on a circuit being pushed by a pimp, yep, and forced to do
absolutely
horrific things every day, right underneath our, yes, noses.
It is, it is real. And if you don't believe me, if you think I'm making this up, look up Veterans for Child Rescue. It's run by a former Navy SEAL, Craig Sawyer. And they actually go out there and they bust child traffickers. And that's why I give a portion of the proceeds from Nobleman to these guys so that they can do their work, because it is real and it is horrific. And like you said, people don't know it's happening. And when you tell them the extent to which it's happening, a lot of them are very reticent to believe, because they just think that, yes, couldn't happen here. That can't happen in America. Yeah. Well, it can, and it does, and it is.
Yep. Yeah, and the magnitude of the problem is so severe that people don't believe it. And for in the U.S., for one pimp to run a small stable of girls, maybe 5-6 girls, he's clearing about $1 million in cash a year. He's able to keep them very effectively imprisoned and entrapped in plain sight.
Absolutely.
Horrible, horrible thing. And I didn't realize you were involved with Veterans for Child Rescue. One of the books I wrote called The Misery Merchant is about domestic minor sex trafficking here in the U.S., and proceeds from that go to a few different organizations, a Shared Hope and Refuge for Women, and then Dream City Church in Phoenix, who they're all involved in different aspects of that domestically. But for Veterans for Child Rescue to be able to go and rescue these girls, especially globally, where typically women have far fewer rights than they do here in the U.S., is an unbelievable and really heroic thing.
What they do, I'm going to admit something to you. I always feel a little bit.
Sorry, William, if you can hear me, You just cut out there. It looks like your phone got muted. Let's see if I can unmute you from this side. Nope, it's not letting me. Yep, you just came back.
I'm back. You can hear me now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. So the last thing I heard was that you don't talk about this often, you don't admit this often, but, and then silence.
Okay. So you know, with regard to Veterans for Child Rescue, and you know, I don't admit this that often, but when I send them money, I very often feel guilty about it because I am here in comfort and luxury of my home. I'm in my bathrobe. I'm writing stories. And then at the end of the month, I send them some money. And they're out there doing hard work. You know, these guys are out there. They're putting their lives on the line. Hey, yes. You know, these pimps that run these prostitution rings, they are willing to kill to continue their business, and these guys are going out there every night fighting the good fight, you know, putting themselves in harm's way, and I'm back here collecting all the money from my books and, you know, sending some of it their way. Here you go. So I get those stabs of guilt. These guys are out there, they're really doing it, and I'm just writing about it. But I do feel honored that I can help them to some degree, and I just, you know, it's not much, but I hope it's something.
Yes. Yeah, one of the guys that I used to work with, he retired from law enforcement a few years back, but he spent most of his career working outlaw motorcycle gangs and some undercover work and buying dope and doing all that kind of stuff. And when he retired, he actually started getting involved with this before that, but when he retired, you know, he kind of distributed all of his stuff to all the guys. Like, it was almost like we were a little bit worried about suicide, right? Like, he's giving away his private possessions. Like, you know, yeah. I've got his old titanium knife plate that's in my vest now. Like, you know, but he was, you know, he left. He last that I heard, he was headed overseas, and he had been doing this type of rescue work in India. And so, he and guys like him were raiding these brothels with nothing but a billy club and a big sack of testicles to go in and rescue these girls from armed guys, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And those guys, they're the real heroes.
Yes.
They are. They're the real life Jake Nobles.
Yes. Well, that took a tremendous tangent, and I think it answered my next question about what usually inspires your stories.
Yeah, most of my stories are all based in some form of reality. Either I'm plucking them from the news or something that I picked up from a source. You know, like Noble Intent obviously deals with Julian Assange. Mm-hmm. You know, and the second book deals a lot with the Mexican drug cartels and things like that. So yeah, I definitely pull inspiration from real life, either things that I've, you know, read in the newspaper or, you know, picked up in crosstalk between operators. Yeah. So yeah, it all comes from someplace real.
Now, in terms of your research, what do you do about researching things that you don't have personal experience with? Do you get technical advisors? How do you seek out help when you need it?
I have been very fortunate to have a series of technical advisors. So what I haven't been able to experience in real life, I have been able to ask. You know, I've been able to go to the special forces community, to a few guys that I know, or to the intelligence community, and pose questions to them. I think the most aggravating thing for those guys is that they'll give me really good advice, and then I'll sort of twist it for the sake of fiction. You know, because it's like, well, yeah. I got to make this interesting. the story always comes first, and I don't always deal in realism, but I try and inject it whenever and wherever I can. I've been very fortunate to have, friends in the communities who are willing to sort of open up, because a lot of times those guys, you know, they don't want to talk. They don't want to be interviewed. It's not like, you know, with law enforcement, you can usually find a detective that's like, hey, you know, listen, I want to write a murder mystery. Would you like to be interviewed? And they go, like, yeah, sure. But, you know, with the special forces community, they're called silent professionals for a reason, because yes. most of the time they're not giving away their secrets, and they don't want to talk to you.
Yeah. When, you know, growing up, in my childhood, the Navy SEALs were largely a myth, right? It was, you know, is it real? Is it not real? Like, who are these guys? They don't exist. They do exist.
Oh, absolutely.
And then now.
I remember those days. Yeah.
And now it seems like, you know, they're probably at least, if given about 30 seconds, I could probably come up with a dozen SEAL books that are, you know, very public. And I'm probably touching, you know, 1% of them. But, you know, even like with those guys writing about their experiences, there's still so much of that gets held back, and so much that's kept, you know, out of the public eye and off the pages. And I would expect with your conversations with those kind of technical advisors that there's still an awful lot that you're keeping off the pages to protect their OPSEC.
You're all right.
Are you still there, William?
There you go, Gavin. You just came back in. I lost your audio, and you were talking about you were talking about apologies to the audience. We're having some technical difficulties.
Yeah.
You were talking about all of the Navy SEALs who have written books, and it is. It's different. When I was a kid growing up, it was there was some question as to whether or not they even existed, and now they're all writing books. So it has changed tremendously over the course of just the last few years.
Yeah, and I would expect, even with your access to, you know, those kind of technical advisors in the spec ops community, that there's still a lot of information that, you know, they're willing to share with you that still doesn't even get to make it onto the page, because, you know, there's still some responsibility, right, to protect from them, to protect their OPSEC, and also you to protect them, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, there are those instances where, you know, they'll tell me something. I'm like, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's incredible. You have that ability? Oh, yeah, but listen, you can't write about that. You know, because we don't want the bad guys to know that. I'm thinking, why did you just tell me?
Yeah.
So, yes, there has been, and as a matter of fact, the book that I'm working on now, Noble Sanction, I'm dealing with some things, and something made it into the book, and I can't even say what it is right now, because I had to send it to a guy who used to work for the CIA and say, hey, listen, so, you know, I came by this knowledge and I put it in the book. Is this okay? Am I going to be able to say this? And he was like, well, we better run that fast. You know, so we're waiting on clearance for that right now. Yeah. We're waiting to see if I might have to edit that. We'll see. There is I think an unspoken obligation of novelists to sort of protect the people that we're writing about, because I would never want to divulge information that ends up getting an American soldier killed on the battlefield.
That'd be terrifying.
No, that would be a nightmare. Yeah.
Now, in reading your series, I really appreciate how you present, you know, real world chaos in the stories. Mike Tyson once said that, you know, everybody's got a plan until you hit them. And my old SWAT team leader used to like to remind us that no plan survives first contact. What's the experience like for you when you're writing these scenes, when everything is going to shit around Jake Noble and he's trying to parry and banter all this?
That is, the axiom is so true. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. And I think for me, one of the, you know, in the military, they do live fire exercises. And one of the one of the most vivid experiences that I've ever had was that feeling of a bullet zipping past your head. And I, you know, to distinctly remember that feeling that this object, this hunk of lead, goes flying past your head. And if it had just been a few inches in either direction, yes, your life would be over, finito, done, right?
Yeah.
That is a real wake-up call. You know, that feeling that you get, just smelling the gunpowder hanging in the air, that's one of those things that I really try to hang on to as I write. And I try to inject that feeling so that the reader can taste that a little bit as they're experiencing the story. And hopefully, you know, they'll take that with them and realize that this is something that the men and women of military and law enforcement face on a daily basis, is that they just have to live with that stress.
Now, how did you go about becoming a writer and studying the craft and becoming proficient enough to the point that you're writing, you know, top-notch thrillers, only a few books into this thing?
First of all, I've been writing for a long time. I've been writing since high school. I remember when I was in high school, I had this awesome idea for a book. I mean, this was going to be a surefire bestseller, and I started writing it, and I was so proud of it that I showed it to my English teacher there in high school, and she even said, "This is you're really, really good. This is a great story idea." And then she had to tell me that, you know, she was really sorry to inform me that somebody else had already done this story, and I needed to go check out a writer named Robert Ludlum and his book, The Bourne Identity. Because I had started writing about a spy who had lost his memory, right? I was like, this is Colton. This is amazing. So she says, you know, you need to go check out Robert Ludlum's Bourne Identity. And I did, and I was just devastated. And I was like, oh, I'll just can't you do it. You know. But then I was encouraged, because I realized this guy's huge, you know, this guy's books are all over, you know, and he's a major author. And if he did this and it really, really worked for him, and I had the same idea, well, maybe I can do this as well. You know, maybe I can really do this. So I've been writing since high school, so I've got a lot of practice. Mm-hmm. And I've been very fortunate to just have those experiences. Really, when I got started, you know, ebooks and self-publishing was not a thing. You know, you had to go the traditional route, and I went that way, where I was, you know, publishing short stories, and my short stories got me noticed a little bit, and then I was able to go to work for Delight Games, which does choose your own adventure books, digital choose your own adventure books, and that was my first experience with self-publishing. It wasn't me self-publishing. I was working for the company, and they were, you know, publishing ebooks, and it really got me kind of turning towards ebooks, going, hey, this is a thing, you know, people are doing this ebook thing. And when I tried to publish Nobleman, I really ran into a bit of a problem, because the traditional publishers and agents that I submitted it to said, this is a really, really great book. We like this. We want to publish it. The only problem is you got all this sticky faith business in there, and we don't like that. So mm-hmm. if you strip out all this religious nonsense, we'll publish this book. And I said, well, you know, I can't do that, because, you know, that's a core tenet of the book, right? And so instead, I took it to some Christian publishers, and I said, do you want to publish this book? And they all really liked it. And they said, this is a great book. Only problem is you have all this nastiness about human trafficking and guns. And we don't want that. So if you get rid of that, we'll publish this book.
Yeah.
And a couple of my friends said, you know, you just need to self-publish this. Because I wasn't willing to sacrifice the core integrity of the story for either publisher. But so finally I said, you know, I'm gonna make a go of this. And I put it out, and the rest is history, as they say. It was pretty popular. So all of those publishers, they were all wrong. The story was fine the way it was.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's one of the big, misunderstandings that I had right before I got a publisher and had a book out, is that my gross misconception was that if the book was good, you were going to get published, right? And that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, if it doesn't fit into what a particular publisher is looking to buy this year, or doesn't exactly fit their market or what they believe their risk tolerance will take, they take a hard pass on it. And, you know, it's not at all an indication of the quality of the work, but, you know, it's so much more complex than that. And my naivety almost, derailed the whole thing in frustration.
Right. For those authors who are listening in, if you're not published yet, or you're writing that first book, don't be at all, sort of naive about what the publishing industry is. The traditional publishing industry, the big five, as it were, it's basically like the fashion industry. You know, it has nothing to do with whether or not your book is good, and it has everything to do with what's in vogue right now, right? You know, for so many of the big publishers, they publish things not because it's good or because it has some sort of redeeming value to society as a whole. They publish it because that's just kind of in vogue at the moment. I remember at one point it was like, having an Indian author, Indian being, Middle East, Indian or Middle Eastern authors were the big thing. And everybody was just angling to, sign that next Middle Eastern author with a book that was, going to be the next Slumdog Millionaire or what have you. And I joked with several of my writer friends that I should just change my name to make it sound Indian. And I'd get a publishing contract. So we laugh because it's funny. We laugh because it's true, right? Yes. It's very much the publishing industry is, it goes through fads. And if you don't fit into that fad at the moment, you're just not going to get published. Doesn't mean your book isn't good. It just means that you're not in with the cool kids right now. Now, that might change, but, really – if you've got a good book, the market will tell, right? Readers don't care who published that book. They don't care if readers don't even know who Simon Schuster is, right? If it's a good book, they're going to lay out their money for it. And that is your job as a writer, to tell a good story that people can read on the train to work in the morning. That's all people are looking for.
Now, on a related note, you also, I think come up a little bit already, but you also have a nonfiction writing guide out. What inspired and motivated you to complete that project and put it out?
That is actually part of an ongoing project. The reason I first wrote it is because I started getting emails from so many authors who were, they were just a little bit behind me in the timeline, as it were. They were working on their first novel and they had discovered me, and here I am, I'm self-published and I'm making a living as an author. So they're going, how did you do this? So I was getting hit daily with emails from authors wanting to know, what is your process? And I thought, I should just, I should put this in, rather than having to, spend 2.5 hours doing emails every day. Mm-hmm. I decided I'm just going to write a book, and here it is. Yep. If you want to know my process, here's the book. that's got everything in it. That way I can just steer people towards that. And my website, literaryrebel.com, has a lot of good writing advice that, again, was advice that I found myself giving over and over and over to authors. And, rather than have to write new emails every day, it's just, here's my website, go look at that, and that'll tell you what you need to know about, outlining or what have you.
Now, aside from writing and countering human trafficking, what else in your life are you passionate about? What gets you out of bed in the morning, and what would get most of your time and effort if you were suddenly flush with Powerball money tomorrow?
I hate to sound like a geek, like a workaholic dweeb, but if I hit the Powerball tomorrow morning, I'd still get up and write. Writing is what gets me out of bed in the morning. But I do also, you know, I you know, love things like playing on my guitar. I had had delusions of being a rock guitarist when I was young. So in between writing chapters, I'm usually plinking on the guitar a little bit. My wife and I like to do indoor rock climbing and things like that. My wife is the biggest outdoors, you know, she's Jane of the Jungle. And she gets me out of the writing room, because if not for her, that's where I would be, you know. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we spent a month in the mountains of Georgia, you know. We did everything from whitewater rafting to hiking and everything in between. So she makes sure that I stay a little bit active and healthy.
That trip made you awfully hard to get a hold of when, you know, we were seeking technical advice and expertise from on high.
Yes, it does.
It's a nice product. Disconnect. Yeah.
Right.
I know you've done it's my bad. I know that, I know you've done, you know, podcast interviews before, which makes me want to kind of lean on your expertise a little bit and maybe do my job for me. Of all these that you've done, what do you wish somebody on my side of the microphone would ask or talk about or bring up and give you the chance to explain?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. You know, I've never really thought about that. I'm usually, because my writing is always sort of centered around real world subjects, and you know, then that inevitably involves politics to some degree. I'm always in my hypothetical imagination when I'm thinking about interviews. I'm like, well, now how am I going to answer this question? Yes. Me with those political questions that are very, very hard to answer. I've never really thought about that. If you give me a day or two, I'll probably come up with a really, really good answer to that.
When you finish with the Jake Noble work in progress right now, it was a Noble Sanction, right?
Noble Sanction is going to be the next book, yeah.
So when that one gets approved and gets released, we can have you back on the show, and I'll give you a chance to answer that one again. You have a perfect, poignant, and, you know, well thought out professor response.
I'm sure. On the flight to Manhattan to the Thriller Fest, I'll probably come up with something really, really good. Perfect. As a matter of fact, that, you know, the Thriller Fest sort of panel, I'm pretty nervous about it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's I don't know if you've seen the billing for it, but it's going to talk about faith and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And when Jeff Wilson writes the Tier 1 series of thrillers, he's a former Special Forces guy. And when he first came to me and said, hey, you know, listen, I'm putting together this panel for Thriller Fest, and I want you to be on it. And I'm thinking, that's never going to fly. They're never going to approve that. But sure, go ahead. You know, I'll do that. If you can get it approved, I'll do it. And he comes back to me a few weeks later. And he's like, well, we're in, you know. And I'm like, oh, geez, now I'm going to have to go and talk about this in real life. Yeah. I didn't think it was ever going to happen.
I got to do a panel at a Comic-Con event a few years ago. But it was, you know, much more – you know, much more germane to my normal everyday writing life in authenticity in cop writing and thrillers. I didn't have to get up and discuss anything quite so personal and profound. So I am really looking forward to it, actually.
Well, I'm glad you're looking forward to it, because I'm kind of thinking like, this is, you know, I'm really going to have to lay it on the line little bit here. I'm imagining some of the questions are going to be pretty tough. And then, of course, you're going to have so many different points of view there that it's likely to get a little bit interesting. So, we'll see how this plays out.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a incredible opportunity for a bunch of strangers to become very vulnerable to each other, and we can all sit in the safety tree together and hope nobody gets hurt.
Right. We'll see if everybody's still friends afterwards.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a favorite preferred crime show or a favorite fictional detective that you read?
Ooh, I do. Yes. I should say I have several. First of all, Sherlock Holmes. I am a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, and I keep meaning to put my first stop the first time I went to London was 221 Baker Street, and I keep meaning to put the pictures on my website, never get around to it. So I grew up reading those Sherlock Holmes books, and I just really really loved them. But since then I've really read across the genre, and I love everything from detective fiction to spy fiction. Vince Flynn was one of my favorites, but I also really like the old hard-boiled stuff like Mike Hammer. Man, those Mike Hammer yes. books were awesome. And I really miss those days of hard-boiled detectives, and I think that I try to bring a little bit of that sort of detective noir feeling to the Jake Noble series. I tried to make him sort of a little bit of a modern day Mike Hammer, as it were. So Mike Hammer, one of my favorites. Of course, obviously anybody who's read my work will know that I'm a big fan of, Brad Thor, Vince Flynn, Tom Clancy, although it's, don't worry, it's not the 800-page doorstop that a Tom yes. Clancy book was. You read through it significantly faster.
Yes. Yeah, I think I had to start Red Storm Rising 3 times before I got through it. Yeah, it was
all the way through it.
Yeah. Now, in light of that whole menagerie of characters from which you now have to draw for the last question that I think you probably suspect at this point, but God forbid it should happen, William, but if you wake up tomorrow and find yourself murdered in the most Florida of manners, what fictional investigator, detective, or revenge artist would you want on the case? Does Noble get the job, or do you bring in somebody a little more Sherlock Holmesy?
First of all, if I was murdered in that Florida fashion, it would be just really weird. Because if you ever look at the Florida news, you'll know what I'm talking about. It'd be like yeah. man killed with an alligator or something like that. So, if I was killed, I would bring in my wife to investigate, and I'm going to tell you why. A lot of people don't know this, but my wife is autistic.
Wow.
And she comes at the problem. So she loves the murder mysteries like me. Yes. We watch Bosch, and we watch, Elementary and shows like that. And she always comes at the problem with such an open mind. She's not looking at any sort of bias. Because she's autistic, she is looking at it with that open mind. She's just studying everything. I'll tell you a funny story. We were listening to a former CIA field officer talk, and he's telling the audience about this mission in this South American country where they were supposed to be meeting with this field agent from another country. And they're saying, we're following the guy around the city before we meet with him because we want to figure out who he is, what he's about. Is this a trap? Is he going to try and blow us up, shoot us up? Is he, is he who he says he is, right? And he says, as we're following him, this guy gets off the plane and we're in South America. It's just hotter than anything, and he's got this big parka on, he's sweating, and he's going into stores, and he's acting really irrational, and we can't figure out what's wrong with this guy. And he's asking the audience, like, what do you think might have been wrong with him? And my wife leans over to me and she whispers, he could have just, he could be sick. He could have had the flu or something like that. And that's why he's, acting really irrational. And I'm like, babe, that is not the answer. Don't guess that. Don't say that. I'm not wanting her to embarrass herself, right? I'm like, don't say that. And a few minutes later, the spy goes, "Well, it turns out, you know, we went ahead with the meeting because this guy had information that we really, really needed. So we decided we had to chance it. And so we went ahead with the meeting. And about 2 minutes into the meeting, this guy just barfs all over my shoes. Turns out he had the flu. He was desperately trying to find some medicine in a country where he didn't speak the language. And my wife just turns and looks at me like, see, I told you.
That's so gross.
She is one of those people that just nothing is off the table, right? She just, you know, like a computer, she plugs theorems in until she finds the one that fits, you know, and like Sherlock Holmes, she just eliminates the impossible until she finds what's left. So yeah, I think if I got killed, she'd be the perfect investigator.
Perfect. Well, you know, that is the first time that Mrs. Miller has made it onto the investigators board for the show. So, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, she's so keen at picking out the killer in movies and TV shows and things like that, that I actually wrote a novel on this sort of, you know, she's kind of she's the main detective. It's an autistic detective. I haven't published it yet. You know, it's still in that incubatory period. You know, maybe people will like it when it comes out. We'll see.
Yeah, no, that's really exciting and a really, really original take. I think that there are too few stories like that. I just recently interviewed a new writer, R.J. Jacobs, who's a psychiatrist, psychologist out of Nashville, who works predominantly with veterans. But he just released a novel that is about a murder mystery, and the protagonist has bipolar disorder and uses that to her advantage to solve the crime.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
You know, I think there are you know, too few stories about, you know, folks whose, you know, the minds work in alternative ways that, you know, have had previously in, you know, our lifetimes a negative connotation, that those really end up being benefits when they're looking and analyzing at things that the rest of us don't see.
It really is. And, you know, like I said, my wife is a perfect example of that. She finds connections that I would never find because I'm biased, because I have that, you know, that neurotypical outlook on life where I'm, you know, looking at the particular subject through this lens, and it says that this guy's, you know, comes from the wrong side of the tracks and he's a bad guy. And, you know, she's not affected by any of that. Right. She puts the clues together and comes to a really, you know, unbiased opinion, whatever that might be.
Wow, that's really fantastic. I'm really, really grateful that you made time to come on the show and share all this with us. This, you know, I only got to about half my questions, but we talked about so much more than I ever expected to discuss today.
Well, I'm certainly glad to be here, and if you ever want to have me back on, you just let me know.
No, I'm definitely looking forward to it when your wife's murder mystery comes out and when Noble Sanction comes out. We're definitely going to have you back on and pick your brain a little bit more about how all the rest of us can do a little better at this.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
You've been listening to Writers on the Beat, where crime writers meet crime fighters, a copyrighted broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Thanks to my guest, best-selling author and Army veteran William Miller, for joining me today. I'm your host, Gavin Reese. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other. Be safe out there.